Ekatra podcast conversations for the curious, essential knowledge. Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to the deep dive. Today, we're opening up a subject that, well, for many of us probably feels a bit like homework, classical mythology, you know, stories about angry gods, tragic heroes, these terrible monsters. It often feels like ancient history. Interesting, maybe, but kind of done. Our guide for this journey is Helen Morales and her really brilliant book, Classical Mythology, a very short introduction. But here's the thing, the exciting part. We are not here today to just memorize names or like chart out Zeus's family tree. Our mission really is to understand why these ancient stories, you know, from Heracles doing his labors to the tragedy of Oedipus, why they aren't just dusty relics, why they're actually fundamental to how we think about power, identity, gender, even today.
That really is the core tension Morales gets into, isn't it?
Yeah.
She makes you step back from just the plot, the action of the story, and she forces you to ask, why do these narratives, stories made in societies thousands of years ago, keep popping up in our politics, our movies, even, you know, deep psychological theories?
Yeah.
It's not an accident they still hold significance. The key insight I think Morales offers is that when we study classical mythology, we're actually studying ourselves, our cultural anxieties, the very foundations of Western thought, in a way. The stories change because, well, we change them.
Okay, so let's introduce the person leading this this charge. Helen Morales. She holds the Argyropoulos Professorship of Hellenic Studies at UC Santa Barbara, so she's really at the top of her field.
Yeah, absolutely. And what makes her take so refreshing, I find, is that she doesn't just, you know, list the myths like a catalog of who did what where. She comes at it like a cultural historian. Her real focus is on something called reception studies, which basically means tracking how every generation after the Greeks and Romans reacts to these stories, reuses them, redefines them over time.
Ah, okay, so she's less interested in the original myth, maybe, and more in its afterlife, its journey from ancient Athens to, I don't know, modern cinema.
Exactly. Yeah, it's biography, you could say.
Hmm.
And she uses these sharp, modern, critical tools, feminist theory, post-colonialism, to sort of unlock meanings that, frankly, older, more traditional scholarship often just missed or ignored. That shift in perspective is huge.
Right. And that perspective really drives her central argument, her thesis, which I think we need to keep front and center for this whole discussion.
It's pretty clear. Yeah. Her main point is classical myths are not static. They're not dusty relics locked in a museum case. They are dynamic, powerful, and crucially, infinitely malleable. They're a form of cultural conversation. These stories are kind of built to be adapted, you know? Mm-hmm. So every time a myth gets told, whether it's Ovid telling it in ancient Rome or a modern novelist retelling it today, it's an act of creative interpretation. It reflects the values, the anxieties of that specific time and place.
Okay, right. Let's unpack the basics then, because Morales starts by challenging that common idea of myth, just meaning, well, a falsehood, like saying, oh, that's just a myth. Mm. So if it's not just a lie, what is a myth functionally, according to her book?
Well, she defines it as a socially powerful traditional story. Notice that. It's not about whether it's historically true. What matters is its significance for the community telling it. A myth's power comes from the telling and retelling. That's what gives it collective importance, makes it stick.
So its truth is really about its cultural usefulness, its social work, not historical accuracy. That's a really fundamental shift in thinking.
It absolutely is. And the book itself is kind of designed to give you this, this conceptual toolkit for critical analysis. It shifts you, the reader, from just passively hearing these stories to actively analyzing them, asking why is it told this way? And who benefits from this version?
And the book's structure takes us on that journey through time, right? We start with Hesiod establishing cosmic order.
Mm-hmm. The very beginning, theogony, stark patriarchal order.
Then we move through Ovid in Rome, adding psychological depth.
Yeah, focusing on transformation and often suffering.
Then jumping forward to Freud co-opting myths for psychoanalysis.
A really fascinating and kind of aggressive reinterpretation.
And finally landing right in contemporary times where these stories are being radically reshaped again.
Exactly. So we really have to start back at the beginning, the Greek beginning, with Hesiod's Theogony. This is the origin story. It lays out the structure of the whole cosmos. And that famous succession myth, you know, Uranos overthrown by Kronos, then Kronos overthrown by his son Zeus. It's way more than just some dramatic family feud.
It's the original cosmic power grab, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It's the foundational story that shows this movement from primordial chaos, this sort of undifferentiated mess, to a strict, structured cosmic order. And crucially, it solidifies patriarchal authority. Zeus wins, Not just through brute strength, though there's that too, but through intelligence, alliances, strategic planning. He creates a divine hierarchy that conveniently mirrors the, let's say, desired human social structure on Earth.
It's really hard to read that today without seeing it as a kind of divine blueprint for Father Knows Best, legitimizing male rule right from the creation of the universe.
That's precisely the point Morales makes. These are what some call charter narratives. They justify who gets to rule, who's defined as chaotic or monstrous, and why that order is supposedly natural and right.
Okay, but here's where, for me, it gets really interesting. When we shift to the Roman world, we see how poets like Ovid take these Greek myths and, well, they change them significantly. In his Metamorphoses, Ovid seems to adapt them to focus much more on psychological depth, on suffering, on intense personal transformation.
He totally changes the tone, doesn't he? Ovid often shifts the focus onto the trauma experienced by mortals who are victimized by the gods' power, their lust, their whims. Think about Daphne, desperate to escape Apollo, forced into becoming a laurel tree. The violation there is palpable. Or poor Io, turned into a cow by Jupiter just to hide an affair. You feel her suffering.
But is that just Ovid being maybe a more modern storyteller focusing on drama? Or is Morales arguing he's making a deliberate commentary, maybe even a subtle political one, about Roman power?
Morales argues it's kind of both. Ovid is definitely showing that myths are flexible, they're elastic, they evolve to reflect new cultural interests. And in Rome, there was more interest in human emotion, maybe a more secular viewpoint compared to the deep piety of early Greece.
Yeah.
So by highlighting the god's cruelty, the victim's suffering, Ovid allows the audience, perhaps, to question divine authority itself, which was a pretty big shift from the Greek source material.
That really does make the myth feel much more human, more relatable, even if it's uncomfortable. But we can't discuss mythology and power without talking about straight-up politics, propaganda even.
Right. And the book uses the Parthenon in 5th century BCE Athens as the absolute prime example of myth as overt political theater. Those famous sculptures, the battle with the centaurs, the battle with the Amazon, they weren't just decoration. Morales shows they were incredibly sophisticated political propaganda.
How so? What was the message?
Well, they framed Athens' real-world victories, especially their recent hard-won victory against the invading Persian Empire, as just the latest chapter in an eternal cosmic struggle. They used these myths, like the Lapiths fighting the chaotic centaurs, to draw a direct analogy. Greek order and reason, that's Athens, naturally versus barbarian chaos and irrational passion, that's the Persians, the other. By embedding their current political situation, their military wins, into these timeless mythic battles, they made Athenian supremacy look like it was divinely ordained, permanent, unquestionable.
Wow, that's such a powerful mood, isn't it? Making a specific temporary victory look like a fundamental truth of the universe.
It's incredibly effective political messaging. And speaking of embedded power structures, Morales reminds us that even the heroes, the most celebrated figures in these stories, aren't simple role models. We have this kind of sanitized modern idea, maybe from Joseph Campbell, of the hero's journey. But classical heroes, they're far more ambiguous, complex, flawed.
It sounds like Morales is really tearing down that cozy modern image of the hero as just a flawless champion. How dark does she get with figures like Heracles?
Oh, pretty dark, and necessarily so. Heracles performs these amazing labors, civilizing the world in some ways. But he's also a figure of uncontrollable rage. He murders his own wife and children in a fit of madness sent by Hera. And Odysseus. Yes, he's cunning, resourceful, the ultimate survivor. But he's also a ruthless liar, a trickster, capable of really shocking cruelty to get home. They don't offer a simple how-to-be-good manual.
So they embody the contradictions within the society itself, civilization versus savagery.
Precisely. They embody that constant tension. The myths use these deeply flawed, often violent figures to force the ancient Greeks and us now to grapple with what heroism actually means. How does civilization define itself against chaos, both the chaos outside and the chaos lurking within? That complexity is exactly why these stories endure, why they still resonate.
Okay, let's try and pull back a bit and maybe synthesize some of the key critical takeaways Morales offers us from looking at myths this way. If politics and power is one major theme,
then the next has to be deconstructing gender. Absolutely central. Morales uses that sharp feminist lens brilliantly. She shows how female power, when it does appear, is almost always depicted as monstrous, vinkel, Medusa, the sirens, Scylla, or dangerously transgressive like Medea. This reveals a really deep-seated patriarchal assumption that female agency, female power, is inherently dangerous and needs to be contained, punished, or destroyed.
Right. And those awful stories of divine rape, Zeus and Leda, Hades and Persephone, she reads them not as some kind of, you know, unfortunate romance, but as blunt depictions of violence, of power imbalance, stripping away any romantic veneer.
Exactly. Which gives so much context for why modern writers, especially women writers, are now taking up these very figures, Penelope, Circe, Medusa, Medea, and deliberately rewriting their stories from their perspective, reclaiming their agency.
Which leads perfectly into the third big theme you mentioned. Reception is a creative act. Every era fundamentally remakes these myths in its own image.
Yeah, this point is just vital. It underscores the dynamism we talked about. A classic, maybe the most famous example she uses is Freud and Oedipus. Freud took the ancient Greek tragedy of Oedipus, which for the Athenians was profoundly about fate, knowledge, limitations of human understanding, civic pollution, and he basically stripped all that original context away.
Wait, he just ignored the Athenian focus on fate and free will entirely.
Pretty much. He performed this really aggressive act of modernization. He projected his era's concerns, specifically repressed sexual desire, family dynamics, onto this ancient story. He turned Oedipus into a supposedly universal, timeless key to the human psyche, the Oedipus complex. It perfectly shows how modern eras project their own anxieties and preoccupations onto the past. The myth becomes a mirror, reflecting the concerns of the person looking into it.
That's fascinating. Those key themes, the politics, the gender construction, the act of reception, they really capture her critical approach. There were a couple of, well, not direct quotes maybe, but core ideas paraphrased from the book that really stuck with me.
Oh yeah, go on.
Okay, first, a myth is best understood not as a false story, but as a socially powerful traditional story. Its truth is secondary to its significance for the community that tells it. That definition, you know. Significance over literal truth. We keep coming back to that.
That idea alone is just foundational for understanding any kind of cultural story, really.
And the second one was something like, every retelling of a myth, from Ovid's poetry to a modern feminist novel, reveals more about the values and anxieties of the retellers' own time than it does about the ancient original. That constant reminder to read the present in the retelling.
Yes. Those two points perfectly summarize the conceptual toolkit the book gives you. It really equips you not just to know the myths, but to understand how to analyze them, how they function.
Okay, so let's bring it home then. We aren't all classicists studying Hesiod manuscript fragments. How do we apply this incredible toolkit, you know, in our actual lives when we're just watching Netflix or reading the news?
Well, I think it gives us invaluable critical media literacy. That's maybe the most direct application. The book trains you to spot these mythic structures, the archetypes, the hero's journey framework, the scapegoat, the monster in contemporary stuff, films, blockbuster novels, advertising, and especially, I'd argue, in political rhetoric. So next time you watch a superhero movie, you're not just watching spandex and explosions. You're watching a modern version of, say, the Heracles narrative, complete with flaws, maybe struggles between order and chaos, civilizing impulses versus destructive ones. You can see the bones of the old stories.
And it also helps us re-examine social norms, right?
Yeah.
By showing the patriarchal roots, the assumptions embedded in these foundational stories.
Exactly. It empowers you, the listener, the reader, to identify how those ancient narratives might still be shaping our expectations of men and women today, often unconsciously. You think about how Medusa is being used now. She's being actively reappropriated, no longer just the terrifying Gorgon monster whose gaze turns men to stone. Now she's frequently reclaimed by feminist artists and writers as this potent symbol of justified female rage, of power turned back against the systems that silence or victimize women. That's active myth-making happening right now. We're still doing it.
That ongoing act of reframing is really powerful. It shows just how alive this subject is. You know, what surprised me most digging into this was realizing that the greatest value of classical mythology isn't just its history, but its ongoing vitality. It's still a battleground, isn't it? A place where we hash out our most pressing contemporary issues, gender, power, identity, politics.
And that, I think, is the book's unique strength. It's not a who's who of the gods on Mount Olympus. It's a rigorous, but also really practical how-to guide for thinking critically. We come away from it empowered, hopefully, to analyze any story, whether it's thousands of years old or was posted online 5 minutes ago, with a much more informed, much more critical eye, understanding the work it's doing.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.